This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Holding Up the Universe by Jennifer Niven. Read for you by Georgina Marie and Robbie Damond. Atticus.
He was real nice. Most people are, Scout, when you finally see them.
To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee.
I'm not a shitty person, but I'm about to do a shitty thing. And you will hate me, and some other people will hate me, but I'm gonna do it anyway to protect you and also myself. This will sound like an excuse, but I have something called prosopagnosia, which means I can't recognize faces, not even the faces of the people I love, not even my mom. Not even myself. Imagine walking into a room full of strangers. People who don't mean anything to you because you don't know their names or histories. Then imagine going to school or work, or worse, your own home, where you should know everyone. Only the people there look like strangers too. That's what it's like for me. I walk into a room and I don't know anyone. That's every room, everywhere. I get by on how a person walks, by gestures, by voice, by hair. I learn people by identifiers. I tell myself, Dusty has ears that stick out and a red-brown afro. And then I memorize this fact so it helps me find my little brother. But I can't actually call up an image of him and his big ears and his afro unless he's in front of me. Remembering people is like the superpower everyone seems to have but me. Have I been officially diagnosed? No. And not just because I'm guessing this is beyond the pay grade of Dr. Bloom, town pediatrician. Not just because for the past few years, my parents have had more than their share of shit to deal with. Not just because it's better not to be the freak. But because there's a part of me that hopes it isn't true. That maybe it will clear up and go away on its own. For now, this is how I get by. Nod slash smile at everyone. Be charming. Be on. Be goddamn hilarious. Be the life of the party, but don't drink. Don't risk losing control. That happens enough when sober. Pay attention. Do whatever it takes. Be lord of the douche. Anything to keep from being the prey. Always better to hunt than be hunted. I'm not telling you all this as an excuse for what I'm about to do, but maybe you can keep it in mind. It's just the only way to stop my friends from doing something worse, and it's the only way to stop this stupid game. Just know that I don't want to hurt anyone. That's not why. Even though that's the thing that's going to happen. Sincerely yours, Jack. P.S. You're the only person who knows what's wrong with me. Prosopagnosia. Prosopagnosia. Noun. 1. An inability to recognize the faces of familiar people, typically as a result of damage to the brain. 2. When everyone is a stranger.
18 hours earlier. Libby. If a genie popped out of my bedside lamp, I would wish for these three things. My mom to be alive, nothing bad or sad to ever happen again, and to be a member of the Martin Van Buren High School Damsels, the best drill team in the tri-state area. But what if the damsels don't want you? It is 3:38 a.m., and the time of night when my mind starts running around all wild and out of control, like my cat George when he was a kitten. All of a sudden, there goes my brain, climbing the curtains. There it is, swinging from the bookshelf. There it is, with its paw in the fish tank and its head underwater. I lie on my bed, staring up into the dark, and my mind bounces across the room. What if you get trapped again?
What if they have to knock down the cafeteria door or the bathroom wall to get you out? What if your dad gets married and then he dies and you're left with the new wife and step-siblings? What if you die? What if there is no heaven and you never see your mom again? I tell myself to sleep. I close my eyes and lie very still. Very still. For minutes. I make my mind lie there with me and tell it, sleep, sleep, sleep. What if you get to school and realize that things are different, and kids are different, and no matter how much you try, you will never be able to catch up to them? I open my eyes. My name is Libby Strout. You've probably heard of me. You've probably watched the video of me being rescued from my own house. At last count, 6,345,981 people have watched it, so there's a good chance you are one of them. 3 years ago, I was America's fattest teen. I weighed 653 pounds at my heaviest, which means I was approximately 500 pounds overweight. I haven't always been fat. The short version of the story is that my mom died and I got fat. But somehow, I'm still here. This is in no way my father's fault. 2 months after I was rescued, we moved to a different neighborhood on the other side of town. These days, I can leave the house on my own. I've lost 302 pounds, the size of two entire people. I have around 190 left to go, and I'm fine with that. I like who I am. For one thing, I can run now, and ride in the car, and buy clothes at the mall instead of special ordering them. And I can twirl. Aside from no longer being afraid of organ failure, that may be the best thing about now versus then. Tomorrow is my first day of school since fifth grade. My new title will be high school junior, which, let's face it, sounds a lot better than America's fattest teen. But it's hard to be anything but terrified out of my skull. I wait for the panic attack to come.
Jack. Caroline Luchamp calls before my alarm goes off, but I let her go to voicemail. I know whatever it is, it's not going to be good, and it will be my fault. She calls three times, but only leaves one message. I almost delete it without listening, but what if her car broke down and she's in trouble? This is, after all, the girl I've dated off and on for the past 4 years. We're that couple. That on-again, off-again, everyone assumes we'll end up together forever couple. Jack, it's me. I know we're taking a break or whatever, but she's my cousin. My cousin! I mean, my cousin, Jack. If you wanted to get back at me for breaking up with you, then congratulations, jerkwad. You've done it. If you see me in class today, or in the hallways, or in the cafeteria, or anywhere else on Earth, do not talk to me. Actually, just do me a favor and go to hell. 3 minutes later, the cousin calls. And at first, I think she's crying. But then you can hear Caroline in the background. And the cousin starts yelling, and Caroline starts yelling. I delete the message. 2 minutes later, Dave Kaminsky sends a text to warn me that Reed Young wants to kick my face in for making out with his girlfriend. I text, I owe you. And I mean it. If I'm keeping score, Cam's helped me out more times than I've helped him. All this fuss over a girl who, if we're being honest, looks so much like Caroline Luchamp that, at least at first, I thought it was her. Which means, in some weird way, Caroline should be flattered. It's like admitting to the world that I want to get back together with her, even though she dumped me the first week of summer so that she could go out with Zach Higgins. I think of texting this to her. But instead, I turn off my phone and close my eyes and see if I can't transport myself right back into July. The only thing I had to worry about then was going to work, scavenging the local scrapyard, building mind-blowing projects in my kick-ass workshop, and hanging out with my brothers. Life would be so much easier if it was just Jack, plus scrapyard, plus kick-ass workshop, plus mind-blowing projects. You should never have gone to the party. You should never have had a drink. You know you can't be trusted. Avoid alcohol, avoid crowds, avoid people. You only end up pissing them off.
Libby. It's 6:33 a.m., and I am out of bed and standing in front of the mirror. There was a time a little over 2 years ago when I couldn't, wouldn't, look at myself. All I saw was the bunched-up face of Moses Hunt, yelling at me across the playground. No one will ever love you because you're fat! And the faces of all the other fifth graders as they started to laugh. You're so big you block the moon. Go home, flabby stout. Go home to your room. Today, for the most part, I only see me. Adorable navy dress, sneakers, medium longish brown hair that my sweet but slightly demented grandmother once described as the exact color of Highland cattle. And the reflection of my giant, dirty cotton ball of a cat. George stares at me with wise gold eyes, and I try to imagine what he might say to me. 4 years ago, he was diagnosed with heart failure and given 6 months to live. But I know him well enough to know that only George will decide when it's time for George to go. He blinks at me. Right now, I think he would tell me to breathe. So I breathe. I've gotten really good at breathing. I look down at my hands, and they're steady, even if the fingernails are bitten to the quick, and weirdly, I feel pretty calm, considering. I realize the panic attack never came. This is something to celebrate, so I throw on one of my mom's old albums and dance. Dancing is what I love most, and dancing is what I plan to do with my life. I haven't taken lessons since I was 10, but the dance is in me, and no lack of training can make that go away. I tell myself, maybe this year, you can try out for the damsels. My brain goes zooming up the wall where it hangs, shaking. What if it never happens? What if you die before anything good or wonderful or amazing ever happens to you? For the past 2.5 years, the only thing I've had to worry about has been my survival. The focus of every single person in my life, including me, has been, we just need to get you better. And now I'm better. So what if I let them down after all the time and energy they've invested in me? I dance harder to push the thoughts out until my dad thumps on the door. His head appears. You know I love a good Pat Benatar song first thing in the morning, but the question is, how do the neighbors feel? I turn it down a little, but keep on moving. When the song is over, I find a marker and decorate one shoe. As long as you live, there's always something waiting. And even if it's bad, and you know it's bad, what can you do? You can't stop living. Truman Capote. In Cold Blood. Then I reach for the lipstick my grandmother gave me for my birthday, lean into the mirror, and paint my lips red.
Jack. I hear the shower running and voices downstairs. I pull the pillow over my face, but it's too late. I'm awake. I turn on my phone and text first Caroline, then Cam, then Reed Young. The thing I say to all of them is that I was very drunk, an exaggeration, and it was very dark. It was. And I don't remember anything that happened because I was not only drunk, I was upset. There's just this shit happening at home that I can't talk about right now. So if you can bear with me and find it in your heart to forgive me, I'll be forever in your debt. The shit happening at home part is completely true. For Caroline, I throw in some compliments and ask her to please apologize to her cousin for me. I say I don't want to contact her directly because I've already made a mess of things, and I don't want to do anything else to make things worse between Caroline and me. Even though Caroline was the one who broke up with me, and even though we're currently in an off-again phase, and even though I haven't seen her since June, I basically eat crow and then throw it up all over my phone. This is the price I pay for trying to keep everyone happy. I drag myself down the hall to the bathroom. The thing I need most in this world is a long, hot shower. But what I get instead is a trickle of warm water followed by a blast of Icelandic cold. 60 seconds later, because that's all I can bear, I get out, dry off, and stand in front of the mirror. So, this is me. I think this every time I see my reflection. Not in a damn, that's me way, but more like, huh? Okay, what have we got here? I lean in, trying to put the pieces of my face together. The guy in the mirror isn't bad-looking. High cheekbones, strong jaw, a mouth that's hitched up at one corner like he just got done telling a joke. Somewhere in the neighborhood of pretty. The way he tilts his head back and gazes out through half-open eyelids makes it seem like he's used to looking down on everyone. Like he's smart, and he knows he's smart. And then it hits me that what he really looks like is an asshole. Except for the eyes themselves. They're too serious, and there are circles under them, like he hasn't slept. He's wearing the same Superman shirt I've been wearing all summer. What does this mouth, Mom's, mean with this nose, also Mom's, and these eyes? A combination of Mom's and Dad's? My eyebrows are darker than my hair, but they aren't as dark as Dad's. My skin is a kind of middle brown color. Not dark like Mom's, and not light like Dad's. The other thing that doesn't match up here is the hair. It's this enormous lion's mane afro that looks like it's allowed to do whatever the fuck it wants. If he's anything like me, the guy in the mirror calculates everything. Even though this hair cannot be contained, he's grown it for a reason. So he can find himself. Something about the way these features add up is how people find each other in the world. Something about the combination makes them go, there's Jack Maslin. What's your identifier? I say to my reflection. And I mean the real identifier, not this giant lion fro. I'm having a right serious moment, but then I hear a distinct snicker, and a tall, skinny blur goes breezing by. That would be my brother Marcus. My name's Jack, and I'm so pretty. He sings all the way down the stairs. Top 5 Most Embarrassing Moments of My Life by Jack Maslin. 1. That time my mom picked me up from kindergarten after getting her hair cut, and in front of my teacher, the other kids, the other parents, and the principal, I accused her of trying to kidnap me. 2. That time I joined the pickup, uniform-free, soccer game at Reynolds Park, and passed every ball to the opposite team, setting the all-time park record for most disastrous and humiliating debut ever. 3. That time I'd been working with our high school sports therapist because of a shoulder injury and, in the middle of Walmart, told the man I thought was my baseball coach I could use another massage, only to discover it was actually Mr. Temple, Mom's boss. 4. That time I hit on Giselle Villegas, and it turned out to be Miss Arbolata, substitute teacher. 5. That time I made out with Caroline Luchamp, and it was actually her cousin.
Libby. I don't have my license, so Dad drives me. One of the many, many things I get to look forward to this school year is driver's ed. I wait for my father to offer me sage words of advice or a stirring pep talk, but the most he comes up with is,
You got this, Libs. I'll be here to pick you up when it's over.
And the way he says it sounds ominous, like we're in the opening scene of a horror movie. Then he gives me a smile, which is the kind of smile they would teach you in a parenting video. It's a nervous smile taped up at the corners. I smile back. What if I get stuck behind a desk? What if I have to eat lunch alone and no one talks to me for the rest of the school year? My dad is a big, handsome guy. Salt of the earth. Smart. He does IT security for a big-name computer company. Smushy heart. After they freed me from the house, he had a hard time of it. As awful as it was for me, I think it was worse for him. Especially the accusations of neglect and abuse. The press couldn't imagine how else I would have been allowed to get so big. They didn't know about the doctors he took me to and the diets we tried, even as he was mourning the loss of his wife. They didn't see the food I hid from him under my bed and deep in the shadows of my closet. They couldn't know that once I make up my mind about something, I'm going to do it. And I'd made up my mind to eat. At first, I refused to talk to reporters, but at some point I needed to show the world that I'm okay and that my dad isn't the villain they made him out to be, stuffing me with candy and cake in an effort to keep me there and dependent on him, like those girls from the Virgin Suicides. So against my dad's wishes, I did one interview with a news station out of Chicago. And that interview traveled all the way to Europe and Asia and back again. You see, my whole world changed when I was 10. My mom died, which was traumatic enough, but then the bullying started. It didn't help that I developed early and that all at once my body felt too big for me. I'm not saying I blame my classmates. After all, we were kids. But I just want to make it clear that there were multiple factors at work. The bullying, coupled with the loss of my most important person, followed by the panic attacks whenever I had to leave my house. Through it all, my dad was the one who stood by me. I say to my dad now, "Did you know that Pauline Potter, the world's heaviest woman, lost 98 pounds having marathon sex?"
"No sex of any kind for you until you're 30.
I think, "We'll see. After all, miracles happen every day." Which means maybe those kids who were so hateful to me on the playground have grown up and realized the error of their ways. Maybe they've actually turned out to be nice. Or maybe they're even meaner. Every book I read and movie I watch seems to give out the same message. High school is the worst experience you can ever have. What if I accidentally tell someone off so that I become the sassy fat girl? What if some well-meaning skinny girls adopt me as their own and I become the fat best friend? What if it's clear to everyone that my homeschooling has really only equipped me for 8th grade, not 11th, because I'm too stupid to understand any of my classwork? My dad says,
"All you have to do is today, Libs. If it completely and totally sucks, we can go back to homeschooling. Just give me one day. Actually, don't give it to me. Give yourself one day."
I tell myself, "Today." I tell myself, "This is what you dreamed of when you were too scared to leave the house. This is what you dreamed of when you were lying in your bed for 6 months. This is what you wanted. To be out in the world like everyone else." I tell myself, "It's taken you 2.5 years of fat camps and counselors and psychologists and doctors and behavioral coaches and trainers to get ready for this. For the past 2.5 years, you've walked 10,000 steps a day. Every one of them was pointing you to now." I can't drive. I've never been to a dance. I completely missed middle school.
I've never had a boyfriend, although I did make out with this boy at camp once. His name is Robbie, and he's repeating his senior year somewhere in Iowa. Except for my mom, I've never had a best friend, unless you count the ones I made up for myself. Three brothers who lived across the street from my old house. The ones I called Dean, Sam, and Castiel, because they went to private school and I didn't know their names. The ones I pretended were my friends. My dad looked so nervous and hopeful that I grab my bag and push out onto the sidewalk. And then, I'm standing in front of the school as people walk past me. What if I'm late to every class because I can't walk fast enough, and then I get detention, where I will meet the only boys who will pay attention to me, burnouts and delinquents, fall in love with one of them, get pregnant, drop out before I can graduate, and live with my dad for the rest of my life, or at least until the baby is 18? I almost get back in the car, but my dad is still sitting there, hopeful smile still on his face.
You got this.
He says it louder this time, and I swear to you, gives me a thumbs up. Which is why I join the crowd and let them carry me along until I'm waiting my turn at the entrance, opening my bag so that the guard can check it, walking through metal detectors, stepping into a long hallway that splinters off in all directions, bumped and jostled by elbows and arms. I think, somewhere in this school could be a boy I fall in love with. One of these fine young men might be the one who at long last claims my heart and my body. I am the Pauline Potter of Martin Van Buren High School. I am going to sex the rest of this weight right off me. I'm looking at all the boys going by. It could be that guy, or maybe this one. That's the beauty of this world. Right now, that boy right there, or that one over there means nothing to me, but soon we will meet and change the world. His and mine.
Move it, fat ass, someone says.
I feel the sting of the word, like a pinprick. Like the word itself is trying to pop me the way it pops my thought bubble. I forge ahead. The great thing about my size is that I can clear a path.
Jack. Like the hair, the car is part of the image. It's a restored 1968 Land Rover that Marcus and I bought from an elderly uncle. It was originally used for farm work before it sat rusting for 40-some years. But now it's part Jeep, part all-terrain vehicle, and 100% total badass. In the passenger seat, Marcus sulks. Asshole. This is said low into the window. Unfortunately for me, he got his license a month ago. You're adorable. I hope 11th grade won't spoil your boyish charm. You can drive next year when I'm at college. If I go to college. If I ever leave this place. He holds up his middle finger in my direction. From the back, our younger brother Dusty kicks the seat. Stop fighting! We're not fighting, little man. You sound like Mom and Dad. Make the music louder. A couple of years ago, my parents got along pretty well. But then Dad was diagnosed with cancer. The week before he was diagnosed, I found out he was cheating on my mom. He doesn't know I know, and I'm not sure Mom knows. But sometimes I wonder. He's cancer clear now, by the way. But it hasn't been easy. Especially on Dusty, who's 10. I turn up the song, an oldie, Justin Timberlake's Sexy Back, and I can feel myself settling once again into my zone. I've got 4 soundtrack songs that I wish would start blasting every time I walk into a room, and this is one of them. We pull up outside Dusty's school, and he goes leaping out before I can stop him. I get out after him, taking the keys so Marcus can't drive off with the car. This summer, Dusty started carrying a purse. No one talks about it. Not my mom, or dad, or Marcus. Dusty is halfway up the walk before I chase him down. I have to keep my eyes on him so I don't lose him. He has the darkest skin of the three of us, and his hair is the color of a copper penny. Technically, Mom is half black, half Louisiana Creole, and Dad is white and Jewish. Dusty is dark like Mom. Marcus, on the other hand, couldn't be whiter. Me, I'm just Jack Maslin, whatever the hell that is. Dusty says, I don't want to be late. You won't be. I just wanted to... Are you sure about the purse, little man? I like it. I can fit everything in here. I like it, too. It's a really damn cool purse. But I'm not sure everyone's going to dig it as much as we do. There might be some kids here who are going to be so jealous of that purse that they'll make fun of you. I see about 10 of them walking past us right now. They won't be jealous. They'll think it's weird. I just don't want anyone to be rough on you. If I want to carry a purse, I'm going to carry it. I'm not going to not carry it just because they don't like it. And in that moment, this scrawny kid with big ears is my hero. As he walks away, I watch the way he moves. Straight as an arrow, chin up. I want to follow him all the way into school to make sure nothing happens to him. 7 Careers for Someone with Prosopagnosia by Jack Maslin. 1. Shepherd, assuming face blindness doesn't extend to dogs and sheep. 2. Toll booth operator, assuming no one you know is taking the route you're working. 3. Rockstar / boy band member, NBA player, or some other profession along these lines, where people expect you to have an ego so massive they won't be surprised if you don't remember them. 4. Writer. The most recommended job for people with social anxiety disorders. 5. Dog walker / trainer. See number 1 above. 6. Embalmer. Except that I might get the corpses mixed up. 7. Hermit. Ideal. Except the pay isn't very good.
Libby. I clear a path all the way to my first class, where I take a seat in the row closest to the door, in case I need to flee at some point. I just fit behind the desk. Under my shirt, my back is damp, and my heart skips a beat. No one can see it, though. At least, I hope no one can see it, because there's nothing worse than being known as the sweaty fat girl. As my classmates trickle in, a few of them stare. A couple of them snicker. I don't recognize any of the 11-year-old kids I once knew in these teenage faces. But school is exactly what I expected, yet more at the same time. For one thing, Martin Van Buren High School has about 2,000 students, so it is a place packed with commotion. For another, no one looks as shiny and polished as they do in the TV and movie versions of high school. Real teens aren't 25 years old. We have bad skin and bad hair, and good skin and good hair, and we're all different shapes and sizes. I like us better than our TV selves, even though sitting here, I feel like an actor playing a part. I'm the fish out of water, the new girl at school. What will my story be? I decide that what I've got here is a clean slate. As far as I'm concerned, this is me starting over, and whatever happened when I was 11, 12, 13 doesn't exist now. I'm different. They're different, at least on the outside. Maybe they won't remember I was that girl. I don't plan on reminding them. I look them in the eye and give them my father's new signature taped-up corner smile. This seems to surprise them. A couple of them smile back. The boy next to me holds out his hand. Mick. Libby. I'm from Copenhagen. I'm here for the exchange program. Even with crow-black hair, he is Viking-like. Are you from Amos? I want to say, I'm an exchange student, too. I'm here from Australia. I'm here from France. But the only boys I've talked to in the past 5 years are the ones at Fat Camp, which is why I don't do anything but nod. He tells me how he wasn't sure at first whether to come here, but then he decided it would be a good experience to see the heartland of the States and the way most Americans live, whatever that means. I managed to say, "What's your favorite thing about Indiana?"
"That I get to go home one day."
He laughs, so I laugh, and then two girls walk in and their eyes go immediately to me. One of them whispers something to the other, and they take the seats in front of us. There's something familiar about these girls, but I can't place them. Maybe I knew them before. My skin prickles and I have that horror movie feeling again. I look up at the ceiling as if a piano is about to fall on my head, because I know it's going to come from somewhere. It always does. I tell myself to give Mick a chance, give these girls a chance, give this day a chance, give myself a chance most of all. The way I see it, I've lost my mom, eaten myself nearly to death, been cut out of my house while the whole country watched, endured exercise regimes and diets and the nation's disappointment. And I've received hate mail from total strangers. It is disgusting that anyone would ever let themselves get so large, and it is disgusting that your father wouldn't do anything about it. I hope you survive this and get straight with God. There are people starving in the world, and it is shameful that you would eat so much when others don't have enough.
So I ask you, what can high school do to me that hasn't already been done?
Jack. With a minute to spare, we roll into the parking lot, into the last empty space in the first row of cars. Marcus drops his phone, and when he sits up again, it's as if he's a brand new person. Like that, the etch-a-sketch in my brain is cleared, and I have to start over, adding up the parts. Shaggy hair, plus pointy chin, plus 8-foot-long giraffe legs, equals Marcus. The Land Rover's barely in park before he's out the door and calling to people. I want to say, "Wait for me. Don't make me go out there by myself." I want to grab hold of his arm and hold on so I don't lose him. Instead, I keep my eyes on him, not blinking because that will make him disappear. And then he morphs into the crowd, moving towards school like one of the herd. The animal kingdom has crazy names for animal groups. A zeal of zebras, a murder of crows, an unkindness of ravens, and my favorite, an embarrassment of pandas. What would this group be called? A horror of students? A nightmare of teens? Just for fun, I scan the faces going by, looking for my brother. But it's like trying to choose your favorite polar bear out of an aurora of them. I sit for 30 seconds, enjoying the solitude. 30, 29, 28, 27. This is it for the day until I'm home again. In this 30 seconds, I let myself think all the things I won't let myself think for the next 8 hours. The song always starts the same way. I have a fucked up brain.
Libby. 20 minutes into class, no one is staring at me. Our teacher, Mrs. Belk, is talking, and so far I'm able to keep up. Mick is whispering clever commentary just for my benefit, which makes him either my new best chum or my future boyfriend, or possibly the boy who will sex the rest of this weight right off me. You belong here as much as anyone. No one knows who you are. No one cares. You've got this, girl. Don't get ahead of yourself. But I think you've got this. And then I laugh at one of the things Mick says, and something goes flying out of my nose and lands on his textbook. Mrs. Belk says, "Settle, please," and keeps on talking. I superglue my eyes to her, but I can still see Mick in my peripheral vision. I'm not sure he notices the thing I shot at him, and I don't dare look. Please don't see it. He goes right on whispering as if nothing happened. As if the world is not about to end, but now I only want to close my eyes and die. This is not the foot I want to start on.
This is not what I envisioned for myself when I was lying awake last night imagining my grand re-entrance into teenage society. Maybe he'll think this is some weird American tradition, like some bizarre custom we have for welcoming foreigners to our country. I spend the rest of the class period focusing hard on what Mrs. Belk is saying, my eyes on the front of the room. When the bell rings, the two familiar-looking girls turn around and stare at me, and I see that they are Caroline Luchamp and Kendra Wu, girls I've known since first grade. After I was rescued from my house, they were interviewed by the press, referred to as close friends of the troubled teen. The last time I saw them in person, Caroline was a homely 11-year-old who wore the same Harry Potter scarf every day, no matter how hot it was. Her other distinguishing factors were that she'd moved to Amos from Washington, D.C. when she was in kindergarten, and she was self-conscious over her feet, which had these very long toes that curled like a parrot's. The thing I remember about Kendra is that she wrote Percy Jackson fan fiction on her jeans and cried every single day over anything. Boys, homework, rain. Caroline, of course, is now 8 feet tall and beautiful enough to be a shampoo model. She wears a skirt and a tight little jacket like she goes to private school. Kendra, whose smile appears to be tattooed on, is dressed all in black and is just pretty enough that she could host us at the Applebee's on the good side of town. Caroline says to me, "I've seen you before." I get that all the time. She stares, and I know she's trying to place me. "I'll help you out. Everyone gets me confused with Jennifer Lawrence, but we're not even related." Her eyebrows shoot up like rubber bands. "I know, right? It's hard to believe, but I went on Ancestry.com and double-checked." "You're the girl who was trapped in her house," she says to Kendra. "The fire department had to cut her out of there, remember? We were on the news." "Not... you're Libby Strout, the girl we've known since first grade, but you're the girl who was trapped in her house and was the reason we got to be on television." Mick from Copenhagen is watching all of this. I say, "You're thinking of Jennifer Lawrence again." Caroline's voice goes soft and sympathetic. "How are you doing? I was so worried. I can't even imagine what that must have been like for you. But oh my God, you lost so much weight, didn't she, Kendra?" Kendra is technically still smiling, but the upper half of her face is pinched into a frown. "So much. You look really pretty." Kendra is still smile-frowning. "I love your hair." One of the worst things a pretty girl can say to a fat girl is, "You look really pretty," or, "I love your hair." I realize lumping all pretty girls together is just as bad as lumping all fat girls together, and I realize that you can be pretty and fat, hello, but it's been my experience that these are things girls like Caroline Luchamp and Kendra Wu say to you when they're really thinking something else. These are pity compliments, and I feel my soul die a little. Without a word, Mick from Copenhagen gets up and walks out of the room.
Jack. Caroline Luchamp is the closest thing I have to a girlfriend. This used to be because she was geeky and sweet, and most of all smart. When I first fell for her, she was the kind of smart that didn't make a show of it. That came later. She would just sit back and soak things up like a sponge. We'd get on the phone after everyone else had gone to sleep, and she'd tell me about her day. What she saw, what she thought. Sometimes we talked all night. The Caroline of today is tall and gorgeous. But her biggest identifier is that she can part a crowd. She intimidates the hell out of everyone, even the teachers. Mostly because she speaks up now, always, and tells it like it is. The main reason we're still at all on again is history. I know she must still be in there, even if there's no sign of her. This new Caroline arrived without warning, sophomore year, which means the old Caroline could possibly come back at any minute. The other reason is that she is generally easy for me to recognize. I turn down my least favorite hall, the one outside the library, the one where Caroline's locker is. When I was a freshman, I worked in the library, and if I run into any of the librarians, they'll all say hi and ask how my family is, and I'll be expected to know who they are. As I walk, people are saying hi to me, and that's a nightmare too. I put on some extra swagger, half smiling at everyone, keeping it casual. But I must miss someone because I hear, "Prick." The waters are treacherous and also fickle. This is the first thing I learned about high school. One minute you're well-liked, the next minute you're an outcast. Just ask Luke Rivas, the most famous cautionary tale at MVB. Luke was the man our freshman year. Till everyone found out his dad served time in prison. Now Luke's in prison too, and you don't want to know why. At this moment, the hall is full of potential Lukes. One kid being stuffed into a locker, another kid tripping over someone's outstretched foot so that he goes flying into someone else, who shoves him, until he's bouncing from one person to another like a human volleyball. Girls trash-talking another girl right in front of her face so that she turns away, all red-eyed and crying. Another girl walking by with a big scarlet A swinging from her back, which leaves people snickering in her wake because everyone but Hester Prynne is in on the joke. For every single laughing person in this hallway, there are five who look either terrified or miserable. I try to imagine what it would be like if the general high school public knew about me. They could literally walk right up and steal my shit or steal my car, then come back and help me look for it. This guy could pose as that guy, or this girl could pretend to be that girl, and it would be really fucking hilarious. Everyone in on the joke but me. I want to keep walking till I'm at the front entrance, and then run the hell out of here. I hear, "Wait up, Mass!" And I start walking faster. "Mass! Holy shit, fuck off, whoever you are. Mass! Mass! Wait up, you fucker!" This guy runs to catch up with me. He's about my height and stocky. His hair is brown, and he's wearing a nondescript shirt. I glance at his backpack, the book he's carrying, his shoes, anything that might give me a clue as to who he is. Meanwhile, he's launching into a conversation. "Man, you need to get your hearing checked." "Sorry, I'm meeting Caroline." If he knows her, this will work. Shit. He knows her. When it comes to Caroline LeChamp, most people fall into one of two camps. They're either in love with her or terrified of her. No wonder you're somewhere else. The way he says it lets me know he belongs to Camp Terrified. "I just thought you might want to tell me to my face." This is yet another nightmare, and they don't give you enough to go on. "Tell you what. Are you serious?" He stops in the middle of the hall and goes red in the cheeks. "She's my girlfriend. You're lucky I don't beat the shit out of you." This is almost certainly Reed Young, but there's a slight chance it could be someone else. I decide to keep it generic while trying to sound as specific as possible. "You're right. I am lucky, and don't think I don't appreciate it. I owe you, man." "Yeah, you do." I hear voices coming down the hall, loud and boisterous, like a mob pillaging the countryside. People are dodging out of the way, and here come a couple of guys as big as the football field. They go, "What's up, Mass? Heard you had a nice time at the party." And they laugh hysterically. I may not recognize them, but these are apparently friends of mine. One of them rams his shoulder into some poor kid slinking past and then tells the kid to watch where he's going. I say to the football field, "Dude, show some respect," and nod at Reed. Then I say to him, "Really, man, you're a good friend." This isn't exactly true, but he and I have been on the baseball team together since freshman year. "Well, I still want to kick your ass, but don't let it happen again." Never. He looks toward the library. A girl stands at the lockers opposite, talking on her phone. He shivers.
I wouldn't want to be you right now.
And he bolts in the other direction, followed by the human football fields. As I get closer to the girl, I can see the light eyes against the dark skin, and the mole she paints on by her right eyebrow, even though everyone knows it's not real. Run away while you still can. She looks up.
Seriously?
She says. And yep, it's Caroline. She doesn't wait, just turns to go into the library, where I can see the librarians behind the desk, waiting for me to walk in there so they can make a fool out of me. I grab her arm and spin her around, and even though I don't want to, I pull her in and kiss the breath out of her. That's what I should have done on Saturday, I say when I let her go. That's what I should have been doing all summer. Caroline's Achilles heel is rom-coms and vampire romances. She wants to live in a world where the hot guy grabs the girl and just plants one on her because he's so overcome with desire and love that he's rendered brainless. So I touch her face, push her hair behind her ear, careful not to mess it up or she'll be madder. For some reason, eye contact as a rule is tough for me, which means I focus on her mouth. You're beautiful. Be careful. Is this what you want? We've been down this rabbit hole before, buddy. Do we really want to go down it again? But there's a part of me that needs her, and hates that I need her. I can feel her softening. If I know Caroline, this is the greatest present I could ever give her. Letting her be the forgiver. She doesn't smile. Caroline rarely smiles anymore. But her eyes dart to the floor, fixing themselves on some invisible something there. The corners of her mouth turn down. She is thinking it over. Finally, she says, You're the worst, Jack Maslin. I don't know why I even talk to you. Which is Caroline speak for, I love you too. What about Zach? I broke up with him 2 weeks ago. And like that, we're back together. She takes my hand and we walk through the halls. And my heart's beating a little fast. And I've got this feeling of, I'm safe. Without even knowing it, she'll be my guide. She'll tell me who's who. We are Caroline and Jack. Jack and Caroline. As long as I'm with her, I'm safe. I'm safe. I'm safe.
Libby. According to Mr. Dominguez, if he wasn't teaching driver's ed, he'd be repossessing cars. Not the cars of people who can't afford payments. No. He'd reclaim the cars of the people who are bad drivers, and then, like Robin Hood, he'd give those cars to an orphanage or to good drivers who can't afford their own set of wheels. It's hard to tell if he's serious because he has absolutely no sense of humor and he glares at everything. He is the sexiest man I've ever seen.
A lot of schools are doing away with driver's ed. They send you out somewhere to take classes.
The way he says somewhere makes it sound like a dark and terrible place.
But we teach you here. Because we care.
And then he shows us a film on underriding, which is when cars rear-end semi-trucks and go plowing under them. At first, this boy named Travis Kearns is laughing, but then he utters one last, goddamn, and goes quiet. 10 minutes later, even Bailey Bishop isn't smiling, and Monique Benton asks permission to go throw up in the bathroom. After she leaves, Mr. Dominguez says,
Anyone else?
As if Monique walked out in protest and not clutching her stomach.
Statistics say you're going to die in a car crash before you're 21. I'm here to make sure that doesn't happen.
My skin prickles. I feel like he's preparing us to go to battle, like Haymitch to our Katniss. Across the room, Bailey goes, Oh my golly! Which is her equivalent of, Holy fuck! Everyone looks ill, except me.
This is because in that moment, as someone's head goes rolling off down the highway, I know the part I want to play here in this class and at MVB High. I'm not going to be a statistic. I've beaten statistics for most of my life. I'm not going to be one of those drivers who gets smashed under a truck. I want to be the girl who can do anything. I want to be the girl who tries out for the MVB damsels and makes the team. I raise my hand. Mr. Dominguez nods at me and my skin goes electric. How soon do we drive?
When you're ready.
Top 8 Things I Hate About Cancer by Jack Maslin. 1. It runs in families, which means even if you're my age, you can still feel like you've got a target on your back. 2. It runs in my family. 3. The way it can hit you like a meteor, completely out of the blue. 4. Chemo. 5. It's really goddamn serious. In other words, do not, whatever you do, smile or laugh about something in an effort to lighten the mood. 6. Having to bribe/bargain with God, even though you're not sure he exists. 7. When your dad gets diagnosed your sophomore year, 1 week after you find out he's been cheating on your mother. 8. Seeing your mom cry.
Libby. I stop in the office of Heather Alpern on my way to fourth period. She is eating apple slices, long legs crossed, long arms draped like cats on the armrests of her chair. Before she was coach of the damsels, she was a Radio City Music Hall rockette. She is so beautiful that I can't look directly at her. I stare at the wall and say, I'd like a damsel's application, please. I wait for her to tell me there's a weight limit and that I am far, far beyond it. I wait for her to throw her beautiful head back and laugh hysterically before showing me the door. After all, the damsels are high profile. In addition to football and basketball games, they entertain at every big event in town. Grand openings, parades, dedications, concerts. But instead, Heather Alpern rummages through a drawer and pulls out a form. Our season technically started this summer. If we don't lose anyone, the next tryout period isn't until January. I say to my feet, what if you do lose someone? We'll have auditions. We'll make an announcement and post flyers. She hands me the application. You can fill this out and bring it back to me, and I'll keep it on file. Just make sure to get your parents' permission. And then she smiles this beautiful, encouraging smile, like Maria in The Sound of Music, and I float out of there, like I'm full of helium. I bob and bounce like a balloon through the halls, feeling as if I'm carrying the world's greatest secret. You may not know this about me, but I love to dance. I'm looking at the faces of everyone passing by and wondering what secrets they're keeping, when someone slams into me. A square-headed boy with a big, ruddy face.
Hey,
he says.
Hey. Is it true fat girls give better blowjobs?
I don't know. I've never gotten a blowjob from a fat girl. People are passing by on all sides, and some of them laugh at this. His eyes turn cold. And there it is. The hatred a total stranger can feel for you, even if they don't know you, simply because they think they know you. Or hate what you are.
I think you're disgusting.
I say, if it's any consolation, I think you are too. He mutters something that sounds like, and probably is, fat whore. It doesn't matter that I'm a virgin. I should have had sex 1,000 times by now for all the boys who've been calling me this since fifth grade. Leave her alone, Sterling. This is from a girl with long swinging hair and legs up to her neck. Bailey Bishop. If the Bailey of now is anything like the Bailey of then, she is earnest, popular, and loves Jesus. She is adorable. Everyone loves her. She walks into a room expecting people to like her, and they do, because how could you not like someone so thoroughly nice? Hey, Libby, I don't know if you remember me.
She doesn't link her arm through mine, but she might as well. Her voice still has the same lilt to it, every sentence ending on a high, happy note. She almost sounds as if she's